Good evening and welcome back to the Journey Home program. I'm your host, John-Mark Grodi, here on EWTN. And once again, we have this great privilege to come together to hear a story of faith and conversion. We're joined by Dino Remedios. He's a Catholic revert. And he now teaches theology at Our Lady of Good Counsel High School in Maryland. We're really honored to have him here tonight to share his story. Dino,
hey,
thanks for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, excited to hear your story tonight.
Yeah.
Teaching high school kids, teaching theology out there.
Doing my best to survive in the jungles of teaching high school, but it is fun and very hopeful every year. So
thank you for that great work.
Yeah.
Well, I'm excited to hear your story. So let's go back to the beginning. You entered the church in 1997, but you grew up nominally Catholic.
So I think I should start from the very beginning. I was born in the Philippines. Mm-hmm. So that's important in a certain sense because I didn't stay there. All my family moved to America in pretty much one big wave around 1980. And so I'm talking all my uncles, aunts, cousins, grandparents, all my mom's side, because my parents divorced, okay? And my mom's like a real short, tough Filipino lady, and she's like, we're leaving, okay? We gotta go. And so she took my two sisters and I, and then her entire family to America, essentially, you know? And so 1980, we all get here, and slowly kind of like in this giant, not immigrant wave, but we went from New Mexico and then to Colorado. And the reason why I bring this up is because that's kind of how I grew up in this kind of close immigrant ethnic family. And so every weekend I'm with, you know, 20 cousins and eating the food from the old country and all this. But at the same time, the elders in my family, I think, wanted us to assimilate kind of as soon as possible. You know, so we were just put right into the Americana culture and system. You know, public school, I mean, that's what we could afford, but, you know, assimilation was, you know, key, I think. So that had its effect on me later on in my life, you know. And by the time we got to America and we were just trying to kind of keep afloat as an extended family. And so when I say extended family, I'm talking about my uncles and my grandparents. We're all very close. Mm-hmm. Things got choppy, you know, in a certain sense, just economically, but also just personally with family issues and divorce kind of found its way and throughout my family. And so things got fractured a little bit. And I, growing up, never really... there was a period we didn't go to church, you know, for a long time. Mm-hmm. And I think when I think back on it, I think it's because of these very turbulent times. And so by the time I'm, you know, a kid, my only real Christian experience was Christmas. And so I really became this kind of what I would call classic American kid in the greater American, mm-hmm. not exactly secular culture, but that kind of macro American culture, you know, like the Christmas story, mm-hmm. you know, we'd watch that. And, but as growing up, I never thought about Christ or I wasn't catechized.
Was the background Catholic?
Yeah, the background was Catholic. So I was baptized Catholic back in the Philippines. Gotcha. And it's a Catholic family that I'm part of. Mm-hmm. And it just became kind of in the background of our American experience. Right. You know, from my perspective, okay? From my experience, there were great gaps where we wouldn't go to church, maybe once a year, that type of thing. You know, culturally, very Catholic. And there was good and bad, I think, in that, you know, in the sense of by the time I started getting really spiritually hungry, I had these, without my knowing it, these kind of Catholic instincts that were there from that Catholic experience that I had that was, even though I may call it now, it was a type of cultural Catholicism, it still had some positive guiding and guideposts to my perspective of reality.
Yeah,
you know,
and
it wasn't, I didn't, you know, realize this at the time. It was just later on and looking back, I start to see, wow, I was maybe more open because of this part of my growing up that when I used to talk about it as a negative thing, you know, I look at it more now as marinating, you know, that it wasn't exactly all for naught. It actually was part of the process of my conversion and reversion. So that was the experience of just kind of this immigrant kid in America, loving America. And, you know, I remember there was a time in kindergarten, my cousins and I were in the kindergarten class. The teacher puts a big giant map of America, colorful map. And she says, all right, kids, go to the state you were born in. And my cousins were smarter than I, so they went to Hawaii. And I remember just this existential moment of like looking at the corners of the map and the blue water part and wondering where the Philippines existed. And it was this moment where I was like, okay, I'm a little different, you know. But I never had a negative real experience of it. It was just one of these more realizations as a kid, you know. Because, you know, when you're a kid, you're just trying to have fun and, you know, hanging out with your cousins and all this stuff. But as time goes on, like I said, the more I look back onto my life from this side of my reversion, my own narrative changes.
Yeah.
Okay. And it enters a certain, there's a certain depth to it that I didn't realize before. You know, when I would tell my story of my reversion in the past, it was pretty black and white. You know, I was lost and then I was found. Mm-hmm. But now when I look back at it more and more, I realize it was very messy, mm-hmm. you know, in a good way. Not always a bad way, but, you know, just a very complicated process. But the Lord was always constantly sending certain people in my life and putting a certain, you know, medicine to certain wounds in my life that allowed me to have this hope, you know. And so that's the interesting part about this side of the story.
Sure.
You know, and so it always makes me think about, what about my conversion? You know, I'm still having my conversion. What about 30 years from now, God willing, 20 years from now, 10 years from now, you know, 1 year from now, when you look back and you can see how there is the Christian life, the life with Christ is never static.
Right.
You know, it's this constant, you know, experience. And even coming up here, you know, flying in from Maryland, I was just so nervous of being a bad example or wanting to be in good spiritual shape. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like 2 weeks before school starts, teachers start dieting, you know, and start doing exercises and trying to fit into their cardigans again, you know, from my experience. Mm-hmm. And so there was a pressure a little bit of me just to come here and tell the story of wanting to make sure I'm in good shape. But, you know, I had to I think here I am, Lord, you know, all of you and all of me, and I'm here to serve you and bear witness to you, you know.
And I think sharing the story is part of the story, right? Because at some point it becomes part of the continuing journey where we look back and we reflect and we keep learning about it. And then turning around to share it. It takes a lot of courage to share the story. That becomes part of the continuing journey. So thanks for coming down to do it.
Yeah. And you know, it still continues, but you know, when I was a kid, my Christian radar was being formed, but it was really just this, not bland, but just this kind of macro Americana view of the Christian experience.
Right.
So like I said, maybe going to church once a year. I remember I had certain relatives who would go to church more. And if I spent the night at one of their houses, I would end up going to Mass and I would just sneak out and go play in the playground while they were going to Mass. You know, I wasn't catechized, you know, I was, you know, I think about it in horror now. If I heard that my kid did that, honestly, I would just, you know, they would not, hear the end of it, but I just didn't really know what was going on, you know, and it always seemed ornamental to me, you know, and I just was very ignorant, you know, to be honest, so very ignorant. And there was a lot of stuff happening in my family that I think that caused that, because like I was saying, there's a lot of divorce when my mom came to this country. You know, there was still divorce that she experienced in later marriage. And so raising me was a little choppy. So there was a big gap sacramentally. So I have two older sisters, two younger brothers. My older sisters got the sacraments traditionally, you know, in the traditional ages. My younger brothers got their sacraments in those traditional ages. But there's this gap period, you know, I'm like the missing link of like evolutionary speaking, you know, this missing spiritual link. Yeah. I just was not catechized, you know. And so by the time I'm entering, you know, high school, I received baptism and that was it. And I can only, you know, maybe gone to Mass. You know, if my mom's watching this, she's probably thinking, I took you every, you know, Sunday. But from my recollection of it, I just did not seem, I did not go maybe once a year. But like I said, though, Christmas, though,
yeah.
Christmas was this anchor deep within me of something beautiful, something innocent, something hopeful, something mm-hmm. redemptive. Now, at the time, I wasn't thinking in those categories.
Right, right.
But it anchored me for later on, you know, I think. So even now, it's still part of, you know, when I hear like Silent Night or yeah. something. You know, this is back in elementary days in the 80s where, you know, we would sing Christmas songs and,
yeah.
you know, like, and we'd do, you know, all the hand gestures of the Silent Night song and everything you'd learn as a kid in America in yeah. the 80s.
Well, like you said, that plants great seeds. You know, even if it takes a while for the catechesis really to kick in or the personal relationship, still growing up with the smells and bells, the sights and sounds, especially around the great feasts and holy days, those do plant seeds, you know, that may take a while to germinate, but they're there.
Right.
Yeah.
Easter was a bit different. Mm. Just thought about the classic getting a basket
right.
of gifts and eggs and all this. I think it still affected me, but Christmas was definitely the number one kind of catechizing or evangelizing thing when I look back, you
right.
know, as far as like liturgically speaking.
Sure.
As far as people in my life, there were, when I look back, I see more and more of them. Mm-hmm. I can kind of recognize them a little more,
yeah.
Playing certain parts of my life that just showed me kindness or forgiveness or responsibility that all help my receptivity.
Sure.
You know, later on.
So as you hit high school and beyond, how did this all play out in terms of your faith?
Well, like I said, I entered high school just an American mm-hmm. kid and, you know, kind of lower middle class, you know, kind of secular culture and kind of open for whatever the culture was saying I should be as a man, as a human being, but as a young man, you know. Yeah. And so that was my experience, and I wasn't religious. I maybe a little spiritual. I kind of had, you know, that classic, you know, bleeding heart liberal experience. You know, I think I went door to door for Bill Clinton at one point. I had this history teacher, very influential, great man. And so there were these certain aspects of justice that I felt compelled, you know, as yeah. not just as a young person, but I really got into politics. Mm. You know, in my high school years, doing these like speech and debate and this program at California called Youth in Government. So I was around positive people, positive young folk, but also the adults who were moderating all these activities. They were, you know, great Christian men, but would never talk to me about Christianity. You know, but when I think about it now, I'm like, oh, okay, this particular adult who was moderating me, he was a practicing Christian, and this mm-hmm. other one was a practicing Christian.
Right.
And so, but it was never mentioned, you know, when I think about it, I never really mentioned it at all. So just did the high school American secular experience. And by the time I'm going deeper into high school, I start taking these philosophy courses, you know, critical thinking class in high school, and incredible class from my teacher who gave me like Plato's Cave, you know, for the first time, or Aristotle's Law. And yeah. it just really started to open me up to the world, or, you know, it made me ask questions about my own view of reality and my
right.
own experience of it, and this desire, do I really want what is true? And that's really kind of what radicalized me, mm-hmm. you know, and kind of started opening me up to this journey that I'm on, is that yeah. this idea of truth, you know, and that really really affected me,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I wanted that. I wanted to know what was true. And there was a longing in me that wasn't being fulfilled, you know, in my experience of kind of a bland spiritual experience, you know. I was really into hip-hop. I was really into kind of a skater scene, you know. So those, I was really into comic books, mm-hmm. you know. And so this kind of geeky, rebellious hip-hop kind of mix allowed these ingredients later on to kind of see the faith in a different light. And so when I look back at it, I was just kind of a normal, fun, positive guy, but didn't really have a spiritual fatherhood, mm-hmm. you know? And so eventually it led me out of the faith. Okay. At first, philosophy kind of did that, mm-hmm. I think, when I was wanting to know what actually is true. And this, in the skater culture or hip hop culture, there's a bit of rebelliousness, not in a bad, necessarily bad way, but just kind of a, yeah. you know, prove it. You know, you can say what you want, but you got to prove it. You got to show some receipts here. And so that part of it was part of my response to looking at things that were macro ornaments in the cultures, like Christianity, mm-hmm. you know, or patriotism, or these big concepts and big ideas. You know, I was young and, you know, obviously wanted to test everything and wanted to make sure if it was true. But there was this going back and back to this idea of what is true, mm-hmm. you know, that's what I want, you know. And I remember writing one time in a journal. I was into a lot of writing and poetry and things like this. And, you know, nothing crazy, but just love stories, love storytelling. And in one of my journals, I think I wrote something like, you know, I feel like a caterpillar asking when, mm. you know. And that always stood out to me. Later on, when I looked at it, that I had this yearning, you know, this deep desire. And what I've initially filled it with was myself. Okay, so I had this desire for the transcendent, but I didn't have it. I didn't know where to go, you know, and so I just had myself, my own reflection, and that's what the culture was kind of forming me in, you know, pleasure and, you know, self-pursuits and things, and egotism, a certain type of egotism that's there. And so that's what I kind of filled the void with, was my own wants and needs, and, you know, and that led me eventually away from the faith, where I think it was senior year, I think, at a party, somehow religion was brought up, or Christianity was brought up or something, and someone asked if I was a Christian or whatever, and I remember saying, no, I wasn't, mm-hmm. you know, and then I started to really get into atheism at that point. So this is around senior year, okay. I think, you know. Now, I wouldn't say I'm like, you know, one of the new atheists doing all my research or, you know, but I would be close to, if I was going to school now, I would have been big supporters of that. You know, yeah. I could have easily yeah. fallen to like the YouTube comments of like, yep, you know, the new atheists are right, mm-hmm. you know. But I got into that version of atheism a little bit. Not really polemical atheism, mm-hmm. but I got into that type of negative view of religion mm-hmm. at first, you know. Yeah.
Well, in some sense, just sort of being honest with yourself about that question that you said, you know, you'd been radicalized by, you know, what is true, and then recognizing that, well, this label doesn't make sense if I don't believe it. You know, and so that is an important turning point, because if a person doesn't really care yet about what is true, then it all just kind of washes over them. So that was a turning point to begin asking that question.
Yeah, and I think all of it was going on in a boy who was broken. Mm. You know, that's what I think. And I still am a child, you know. I'm always going to be a child, you know, hopefully not childish, but, you know, I'm always going to be this child, but I can really see that I was just a broken kid, that the wounds of my past with divorce and leaving, you know, having my parents separate at such an early age, that really affected me in very subconscious, deep ways that, you know, I'm still kind of recognizing it, not that it was the only ingredient in the recipe, but it definitely was a big part of it, I think, you know, of of the way that I would react to things. I think it had these roots in this sense of loss, and which led to a lack of trust. So what was happening by the time I'm in high school and later on is that I was really forming instincts within me not to trust. And so that became my gesture towards reality, is this mistrust. And so that was a big problem, you know, because at the end of the day, then you get cut off and then you're by yourself, you know. So there's this ultimate kind of nihilism that narcissism leads to, and that I was kind of, you know, I think if I'm being honest, I was, you know, narcissistic. But if you knew me back then, you'd just think I was a nice guy. But when I really look back about where was my heart at, it was a type of, you know, tragic view of a hopeless life. So I might as well just enjoy it. And, you know, and I started getting to that, you know, into, you know, my friend gave me a book of Nietzsche and just reading some of that. And, you know, I wouldn't say I was well read, but it was these, you know, these narratives that I would hear that I would be interested in, like, okay, maybe there's no truth. Mm-hmm. You know, suddenly that's kind of what my quest led to, this moment where I finally said, there is no truth, there is no God. Gotcha. You know, but I think that was really a cry from someone who, a boy who was broken.
Sure.
So.
Okay. What happened after high school?
Not much. No, I went to college, but it was like a meandering, unorthodox, you know, vagabond type of way, transferring from this school to another school, this major to another major. And in that time was a good deal of, I would say, moral decay, you know, where it just became a type of hedonism, you know, in a sense of like, I wasn't, you know, wild and crazy, but I was just whatever the culture was saying a young guy should do, that's what I was doing, you know? So it led to drugs and, you know, sex outside of marriage and all these things, you know, this life that was a hungry life, but a starving life, a malnourished life, you know? And ultimately, it was a sad life. You know, and that part of me that wanted the truth and wanted to kind of get out of the cave, so to speak, and really wanted to, you know, whatever the truth was, I would believe it, but I would need to know it's the truth, or else I don't want to waste my time on it. Okay. That part of me was always there telling me, well, why am I so depressed? You know, so, you know, I don't want to be reductive about my own story, but when I think about it in those terms, I could really see, you know, the dark times, I guess, you know. Yeah. And so those were those first few years after high school, a lot of traveling, a lot of sadness, a lot of yearning, you know, but also at the same time, a lot of fun, young guy life, you know, going to concerts or, you know, partying or, you know, the fellowship aspect of it, you know.
Right.
I mean, I wasn't doing crimey, grimy things, you know, nothing like that. But within my heart, I just felt unfulfilled and just disconnected.
Okay. Yeah. Well, let's take a little break there and we'll come back. We'll hear what the turning point was and what began to change things.
Roger that.
Okay. We'll be back in just a couple minutes to hear the rest of Dino's story. I want to remind you, as always, that if you are on a journey, and we're all on a journey, but if you're asking questions about the Catholic Church, if you're thinking about becoming Catholic, we'd love to assist you. We'd love to pray with you and for you on your journey. So go to chnetwork.org and contact us, or sign up for our newsletter, join our online community. Again, we'd love to be journeying with you and help you as you continue that journey. We'll see you in just a couple minutes to hear the rest of Dino's story. Welcome back to the Journey Home program. We're entering the second half of our hour tonight, speaking with Dino Remedios. He's a Catholic revert. He now teaches theology at Our Lady of Good Counsel High School in Maryland. Dino, thanks for sharing your story with us tonight. When we left off, you described your childhood, being an immigrant to the United States, having sort of a cultural Americana Catholicism, that slowly began to give way as you entered into the world, beginning asking these questions of truth, not really finding good answers for them, lots of stuff there. But we left off, you're in the midst of that. Let's pick up there. What happened next?
Well, what happened there was my mom, through her intercession, contacted my dad, I think, in the Philippines, and said, "Come get your boy." Okay, he's off in the plains, messing up in life. And so he summoned me. I was summoned to the Philippines by my father, and he took care of me, and it was awesome. It was great. And but even in the Philippines, I was just doing the same young guy stuff. I was just in the Philippines doing it. He had a girlfriend at the time who was a practicing Catholic. And she was, and I think they ended up getting married, but she was later on a big influence on me. Okay. But at the time, I just thought she was irritating. why ask me to go to Mass? I'm partying here in the Philippines. I have a gap year in the Philippines. Yeah. But I would go and just kind of, not really snicker, but nothing was happening for me, because I didn't want anything. But essentially, going back and forth from the Philippines back to America, staying there for large months at a time, I got to a point where I got really bored. Okay, and so this is kind of how, the Lord was working with me, I think, and my guardian angel was setting a trap, okay? Because I remember I was so bored. It reminds me of I think Walker Percy, he talks about how modern man has this boredom that we don't know what to do with ourselves at 3 p.m. or something, right? In an empty room. And that's kind of what happened. I was just stuck in this my room and very bored. And even though when I think about it now, I'm like, you idiot, you're in the Philippines. You're like in this beautiful place. Go enjoy. Go do these things. But nonetheless, I got bored and I saw on the shelf some books. So I said, this is the new low. I'm just going to randomly pick a book and just read it, okay? Because that's how bored I am. And I end up picking up the Bible. The Bible's there, okay? And I was a history guy. Like, that's something that I always grew up loving. In high school, I would be bored in class, and I would just read my history book for fun, okay? So I really had this kind of genuine love for stories. That's really the thing that really, I think, drove my love for comic books, my love for films, my love for my uncle's stories and for history, this big narrative. I just really enjoyed the vitality of people and their stories. Yeah. And so I pick up the Bible and I'm thinking, all right, this is a historical document. Why not? Okay. It's not going to, it's this ancient text. So I'm so bored, I'll read it. So I'm like, all right, where should I go? I was ignorant, really. I was like, well, first half, second half, let's just get to the good stuff. New Testament. Open it up there. Where should I go? I guess the beginning. And I remember opening it up, and it says, so I'm like, this is the New Testament of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. I'm thinking, okay, this is a little heavy here, but, let's just see where this goes, okay? Yeah. And I just start reading the Gospel of Matthew, verse 1. And, it starts off with the genealogy, which, grace of God allowed me to continue after that. Right. But I was a history guy, so I was like, all right, genealogy, all right, cool. All right, a lot of names, that's fine. Let's keep going. And I'm from a big family, too, so that's all right. And so I start reading that, and, as the days go on, I'm thinking, okay, this is interesting. All right, this is interesting. And the next week, I start to think, man, he's really interesting, okay? Jesus is really interesting, okay? And then, a little bit here and there, then the week after, I start to think, man, these people are so stupid that he's talking to. They don't, He's talking, you know, he's talking about them. They don't understand, okay? How ignorant can these people be, you know? And by the fourth week, I realize he's talking about me. Like, that's, and then I put the book down. Because I got the goosebumps and, you know, it got existential and, you know, I wasn't really ready for that deep tissue massage, you know, I wasn't for that. And so I put the book down, but a week later passed by and I'm like, I got to know how this ends. I got to know how this story ends. And so I start reading it again and just falling in love, you know, just getting wooed by the master. And by the time it gets to the cross, you know, it really was a heavy moment for me because I had to see what happens to him. And then afterwards with the resurrection account and having to really stop and ask myself, is this true? You know, is this true? Did he rise from the dead just like he said or not? You know, if not, he's just like any other historical tale, okay? But if it is, that I have to do something, like, right. Like I have to respond somehow, you know? And I remember just reading that resurrection and putting the gospel down and just saying, Lord, I believe, you know? I believe you. I believe this, you know? And I just, in my heart, just wanted to chase after him, you know? And that was this, you know, moment of grace for me that, you know, when I think about it now, you know, when I'm even raising my own children, my wife and I try to control all these factors, you know, not in a manipulative way, but just try to set them up so good things will happen. But it was very unprepared.
Yeah.
It was a surprising encounter. I wasn't, you know, it was like I think the gospel says Andrew and meets Jesus at 4 p.m., you know, and it was like that, you know, it was like 4 p.m., you know, and I want to know where are you at, Master? Where are you staying? I want to be with you. And so that was this kind of eruption within my heart then of being a child who can say, yes, okay, I trust you. And, you know, and I love you. And, you know, it was almost like, you know, the bones getting, you know, the bones being full of tissue again, and mm-hmm. just my heart, like, I just felt, as a boy, just a brokenness that was healed, you know, so.
That's beautiful, Dina. Excuse me. Yeah, the amazing grace, you know, certainly, like you said, we as parents want to set up our children to have those good encounters and all the situations, you know, but our Lord's great mercy, you know, in many of our stories, right, God shows up unexpectedly in ways we couldn't have predicted or set up, you know, and, you know, we thank God for that amazing mercy.
Yeah, praise the Lord.
Yeah.
So that was the big experience, I think. And, you know, what I didn't mention is that before that, there was a lot of, you know, any good cook will have the pregame has to be very strong. You know, and so the Lord was cooking, you know, and there was some marination earlier because maybe previous trips to the Philippines, maybe a year before that, 5 months before that, there were moments of my where I had an encounter with some cousins of mine or at a party, and it was Christmas, and they found out I was into philosophy, they were into philosophy, and then he challenged me about the proofs for God's existence, and he found out I wasn't a believer, I didn't believe in God. And so he gave me some of these proofs. And, you know, at the time, I don't really think I was buying it, but it did put this notion in the back of my mind that there were some rational arguments, you know, for God's existence, you know. So it kind of opened up this idea that, not that I was a very staunch, like, atheist, it was just a default setting,
right.
You know, that... But when I thought about what was true, that was the most convincing thing, that life was meaningless. And so that, a year before that, I think, started opening up this idea of God where I could just even think about God, you know, because I was caught up in living a young guy life. I wasn't thinking about that. And then I think I started, and then I got into spirituality after that, where I ended up picking up this book called Celestine Prophecy, which was like a self-help spiritual book back in the day that, you know, now I probably wouldn't give it to my kids, but at the time though, it just opened me up with greater awareness of spirituality.
Sure.
You know, it just kind of, it kind of opened up a spiritual radar, kind of spider sense type thing.
Yeah.
And so I think those things were happening behind the scenes for my, you know, I think C.S. Lewis says there's a time where you have to put the weapons down, you know. There's a time where you have to wave the white flag, you know, and that's kind of allowed me to do that, you know, kind of setting up that. But yeah, that was just the beginning, because after that, you know, I kind of had that vigor and that of a convert, really. And I just told my dad and this beautiful woman and beautiful Catholic witness to me. And I said, okay, I'm in. Okay, all right. This just happened last week, and I've discerned in a week what I want to do with my life. And since Catholics in my mind were like the original, historically the oldest, you know, I was like, I'll just start there. Okay. I wasn't like, I don't believe in Protestantism, or I don't believe in Orthodoxy. I didn't even know anything about those things. You know, it was just like, well, this is how my family started out. This is the oldest church that I've heard about historically. Might as well start there. And so I tell my dad, I'm like, look, I want to get the sacraments, confirmation, communion. Let's go. What do I need to do to make this happen? Okay. Cause I have to leave. And he's like, well, you leave back to America like in 2 weeks. I'm like, okay, I mean, I believe it. So what do I have to do? And he said, all right, well, he looks at his girlfriend who's a practicing Catholic at the time. And she says, okay, we'll get someone over here to catechize you. Yeah. I'm like, I don't need catechesis, you know, none of this. But nonetheless, I did it. So this poor young lady comes in to catechize me for 2 weeks. And I had the, you know, just such a rock hard heart and very proud heart of like, I just read the gospel. I don't, you know, need 2 weeks of catechesis here. And I remember the first class, she said, do you know that God loves you? And I just rolled my eyes thinking, come on, I already know all this stuff, you know? And so what happened was those 2 weeks, it ended up taking 2 years for me to finally get my sacrament. So the Lord made me wait those 2 weeks. I treated her so poorly, this catechist, you know. And now I teach, you know, theology to young people for 20 years. So, you know, I think I'm doing my penance for that. But the 2 weeks that I was supposed to do, because I bailed after a week, I went through this other meandering process of post-conversion of finally getting into full communion, you know, with my sacraments, you know, getting confirmation and then communion. And so that was, you know, part of that process of humility that I had to go through. So,
okay. So you finally entered the church, though, in 1997?
Yeah, 97. Yeah. And so remember the Great Jubilee's coming up in a few years. And so we had like the year of the Holy Spirit, the year of the Son, the year of the Father. And so by the time the year of the Spirit and I go through RCIA, I had to do like two different RCIA programs, one in California, one in Louisiana, Northern Louisiana, and one in Northern California. And I kind of bailed out of that one. And so how I was dealing with school is how I end up dealing with RCIA. But I end up getting involved in a local parish, Northern Louisiana, small, humble, you know, salt of the earth folk, and also happened to be somewhat adjacent to the Catholic Charismatic movement, just because of Alexandria by Bishop Sam Jacobs. He had a Steubenville youth conference there in Alexandria. And so it kind of filtered across the diocese, okay? And so I just started getting involved in youth ministry and hearing about different things in the Catholic world. You know, I just wasn't going to Mass. But that's how I started getting more catechized at that point and then started actively do youth ministry. But the big gift, I think, was just being docile and just being open. You know, there was nothing in those years, nothing tribal or partisan going on. It was just, okay, here's what we're doing here. All right, cool. And then we go to this parish and we're doing this thing, and that's cool too. You know, so there was no, it was very innocent, my experience, you know, and so allowed me to fully trust more, you know, and just to be open to the treasury of what the church has and all our spiritualities and everything. Yeah. And so that kind of, so when I finally did the RCA program there, I finished 97, my confirmation saint, St. Maximilian Kolbe. And that, he helped me because in that process, there were still some questions and some questions about Our Lady. You know, because even though I grew up Catholic, I was still kind of a default Protestant because I was a product of the American macro culture.
Sure.
You know, and so, but it, I also did have some sincere questions of, you know, like, why do I need this mediation? Or, you know, what about this aspect of the body of Christ and the Eucharist or whatever? It was really, I remember my RCA teacher was like, okay, any last call here, any last questions? I'm like, well, if I'm gonna be honest, you know, what's up with this, Our Lady? And she gave me some pretty good answers, but, you know, the abstraction of it, the conceptualizing of it wasn't that, you know, it wasn't that problematic. It was the, you know, will I, as a child of God, you know, do I yearn for maternal intercession in the body of Christ, you know? And I remember just figuring out who my confirmation saint was going to be. I watched this one man play of St. Maximilian Kolbe. It was on EWTN, I think. This talented actor, he does all the story of St. Maximilian Kolbe. And just by the end of that story, I was just riveted and just wasn't trying to watch an EWTN show at all. I would just sat down, saw this weird historical tale about World War II, and next thing you know, it's like the gospel all over again. And it just changed me profoundly. And I said, if this guy could do this, you know, and he loves Our Lady like this, you know, it was like a second conversion for me, honestly, because I thought, you know, I want to follow this guy. I mean, this guy, Maximilian Kolbe, has given me a concrete witness of what the life of Christ can be like here on earth. Mm-hmm. And he was completely dedicated to his, to Our Lady. And so,
you know, it's so interesting that, because there's two axes for conversion, right? There's like sort of the horizontal axis of what we believe, right? But the vertical axis, so to speak, is just this question of the state of our hearts, right? And for some of these issues, like Our Lady, again, it's not so much the what. Some degree, you can look at the what on paper. What do we actually believe? And it can kind of make sense. Okay, I can give it that, but the bigger journey for many people is just this question, but I don't really want that, or that. It does challenge our ego, our pride, you know. And there's a great wisdom there in our God who chooses to work through specific people and places and things,
right,
which, you know, sometimes we think we're really submitting to Christ, but we're still doing so on our own terms.
Right, exactly.
And it's when God calls us into this interdependence of intercession and service that it's like, oh, actually, I have a lot more surrender to do.
Yeah. And it was a double whammy because it opened me up to the communion of saints, you know, and they're both kind of yin yang of each other, but, and you know, Our Lady and her maternal intercession in my life, you know. Yeah. And so after that, I was engaged at the time. It failed, thankfully, and for both parties. And I remember just saying, I think I'm just going to go to Steubenville. I heard about this school, Franciscan University, and I end up going there, and I was looking at the backdrop of this. This is the Tiber, right?
Yes.
And so I remember watching Franciscan University Presents on EWTN, because I was a big Han nerd too, you know, eating it all up, going to like Protestant coffee houses back. I don't know if the viewers remember the 2000s, or no, this is the late 90s. I think the late 90s, the coffee house scene was big, you know, for listening to a lot of, I got rid of all my hip hop stuff. I got rid of, so I got into that point where I was buying Bibles for my siblings for Christmas and they hated me, you know, and then I had to grow a little bit, you know, but going to these, you know, getting testaments at the Christian bookstore and, you know, listening to Christian hip hop or reading these Christian books. And then, you know, so I was always open to, you know, our Protestant brothers and sisters in that sense. They helped me, they helped minister to me and gave me a lot of like incredible witness of beautiful Presbyterian communities over there, and just an awesome witness to me, you know, to be pious and devout and following Christ. And so this all kind of helped me, because by the time I go to Franciscan University, I end up meeting my wife there and just falling deeper into love with the faith. And that, and then I see a book, it says Total Consecration by St. Louis de Montfort. And it says, in, you know, a quote from John Paul II was, "This was the most pivotal experience of my life." And I'm thinking, wow, okay, because I really respected John Paul II. He was, you know, he was during that time of my conversion. And so I said, okay, let's do it. And that same kind of docility of being open to it, which, you know, I know how egotistical I am, that takes a lot of grace to kind of allow me to be trustful and open my hands to the gift. That was just an incredible gift to me, the Marian consecration, you know, and that still guides my family and I, even to this day, we, you know, try to consecrate ourselves to Our Lady after every Mass and just try to serve Christ through her intercession. And then that Marian consecration led me to a, even a deeper level of devotion to St. Joseph, you know, and to this growing desire to follow his path in my life as as a man and as a protector. And, you know, so it's just been grace upon grace. You know.
So you met your wife at Franciscan? And this is after you...
This is after my reversion. And this is like 99 now to 2001. I get there, and I didn't know what's... the reason why I brought up this image back here is because watching Franciscan University Presents, you know, as kind of a revert nerd, just, you know, I was the type of guy who would watch biblical, the mysteries of the Bible, you know, and like, I would record it, you know, because I was really into, I wanted to know more, you know, I had this hunger for theology. So I'd watching EWTN, Franciscan University Presents, and I saw the beginning of the show would have like the this river scene with these buildings and people on boats or whatever. And I thought, that must be Steubenville. And so when I drove up there in 99, I had no idea anything about Steubenville other than that intro of that show, Franciscan University Presents, with Father Mike and Han and Dr. Martin and stuff. And when I got there, there was a river, but it wasn't, it was, there were buildings and there was a river, but it was very different type of buildings and the river was a bit different. Yeah. And I remember driving up and it was a big snowstorm in 99, and I thought I saw a statue of Our Lady. So I want to be very pious about it. So I do the sign of the cross and just, I just want to, I'm here now. And then I realized it was a steel mill worker. It was a statue of a steel mill worker. And I thought, okay, all right, okay. I have so much to learn.
Good intentions.
Yeah, good intentions. I have so much to learn still. So, and that was just, you know, the beginning of the further conversion. Yeah. And then falling deeply in love with theology.
Right.
And then so I went back with history and theology. After Steubenville, I just studied more theology and just fell in love with it. And I said, okay, I want to teach it. And 20 years later, here I am still teaching. So
yeah, well, we have just about 5 minutes left. And so how, since then, you know, how the journey obviously continues in terms of discovering the faith and going deeper.
Right.
You know, what is, as you've continued to reflect and go on this journey, what have you discovered?
Loaded question. Discovered, I think, just the beauty of the faith and the deep humanity of it, the wisdom of everything the Lord taught me from initial experience, you know, something like forgiving your enemy, you know, it's like a lifetime of a degree, you know, that I'm still having to worry, to work on. And it's something I'll tell my students constantly, all the time. But, you know, so that, it just, the depth of his claim upon my heart just increases, you know, and his teachings and his guidance in my life, and just wanting to be his fully, you know, and being his fully makes me fall deeper in love with the church, his body. And so I've always just had, I think, this desire or gift of just being open to that, you know, like all of it. Okay. Like the total church, you know, the Christ in the poor, Christ in the sacraments, Christ in the scriptures, Christ in the priesthood, you know, Christ in whatever is true and whatever is beautiful and whatever is good. And so that is just, you know, open up this adventure, you know. The one thing that comic books did for me as a kid was open me up to a wide view of reality and this kind of wonder. And that kind of was really what kind of radicalized me later on to be more open to a greater horizon of what is magnificent and what is wondrous and what's really calling me. So, and I see that teaching, you know, with my students.
Right.
I see that a lot. You know, every year I teach, it's, you know, full of mud and blood, but at the end it's such great hope. And, you know, I just see it in them all the time. And it helps me want to bear witness to Christ more in my own life. So.
Right. A big part of your story was, you know, again, being awakened to this question of what is true, and you know, for whatever reason, not at least initially, seeing the church as a place to encounter those kinds of questions and answers and to take that seriously.
Yeah.
How does that play, that experience, those experiences play into now you've been called to teach high school students?
Well, it's a joy because I just want to open up the treasury and, like, let's go, let's enjoy this. So not like a museum, but this is, you know, like an adventure would, you know, anyone who knows good paths up a mountain, you know, some guides know where the river looks beautiful at a certain time of the day. And some people, you know, and so there's that aspect of teaching, you know, always learning new paths and always falling deeper in love with the journey, you know.
Yeah.
And so, which is leading to this full communion with Christ more. And so that, when I think about it, you know, I'm just stunned by this job that I get to have, you know, that I get to be part of this line of proclamation for 2,000 years to really shout from the rooftops that the Lord has risen from the dead, just as he said. It's true. It's all true. You know, it's like the end of the great movie Life is Beautiful. You know, at the end, the kid, not to spoil it for anyone, but it's been a while, but he says, it's true, you know, and that kid is still within me, you know, and, you know, not a truth that's going to ultimately just pacify me, but really a truth that allows me to be in communion with God, you know, and in a real way, you know, and that's really the thing that my job really allows me to do, is to bear witness to Christ, but also puts a burden that I have my own, you know, good, bad, ugly, that's part of it, but I'm sure Christ knows that.
Yeah, you know, like you said, falling in love with the journey and helping encourage other people just to not give up. That's one of the main things. I was thinking during your story, you know, that classic quip, I don't remember where it originates from, but, you know, the first draft of science,
right.
And you can replace science with philosophy, with lots of things in there. The first draft makes you an atheist.
Right.
Because maybe before that point, you never really asked what's true, and there's an existential crisis there.
Right.
But if you get to the bottom of the glass,
right,
you find God again. And so that's, I think, true with so many young people.
Yeah.
Their first taste of questioning,
right,
you know, kind of sends them for a loop. And they need people who say, it's okay to ask these big questions. Just don't give up. Don't stop. Keep going with them.
Yeah, I think the saints really were big, and they still are a big witness of that to me, that here's this authentic, concrete life, you know, that this is not, you know, a cheap piece of evidence.
Right.
You know, this is a lifetime given to us, bearing witness to this beautiful, you know, this liberating gospel that we have.
Yeah.
You know, so the life of Maximilian Kolbe still, I mean, guides me every day, you know, opening me up to try to, you know, he says, I see Mary everywhere. I see trouble nowhere. You know, I'm not at that level, but I want to be, you know, because I think it's true.
Yeah.
You know, so it's just to fall in love with the church, which is the full body of Christ, has been this great gift after my conversion.
Yeah.
You know, to continue to really try to serve her and try to be humble in the gift of who she is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Dino, for sharing your story tonight. Yeah. Thank you for your work, you know, out there catechizing our young people.
Yeah, pray for me.
Absolutely. Yeah, we'll be praying for you. If you want to contact Dino, his email address is dinoremedios@gmail.com. And once again, I pray that his story tonight was inspiration and encouragement to you on your journey. Because remember, you're still on a journey. All of us on this side of heaven, we remain people on the way, on the journey with Christ. And so let's keep praying for each other. In the meantime, we'll be back next week with another story. See you then.